Good evening. This is Mae Brussel, KAZU-FM in Pacific Grove, California. This is broadcast number 598, May 23rd, 1983, side one of the tape cassette that is taken off the air and broadcast simultaneously. The tapes go out by subscription. That's why we number them. Sometimes the listeners on the station don't understand why each broadcast is numbered. Usually I begin the program by saying what we discussed 1 year ago tonight. I forgot to do that last week, so I'll just skip back to May 16th briefly. Tape number 545, May the 16th, 1982, a year ago last week, because I forgot to mention it. I went into detail about a man who was written up in the magazine Gung Ho, May 1982. The author was William Seymour, S-E-Y-M-O-U-R. That's the same name as the anti-Castro Cuban that worked with Lee Harvey Oswald and the Lee Harvey Oswald doubles. The article is called The CIA's Man for All Nations. I can't assume it's the same person that worked with Oswald, but because the person he's writing about did work with the anti-Castro Cubans that killed John Kennedy and were involved in that role, it would be worth investigating this. We've had a year, but really haven't gone into it. The gentleman's name is Helmut Stryker, S-T-R-E-I-C-H-E-R, Helmut Stryker. And I was giving the chronology of his work as a double agent. Now, he was a spy for Germany, and he came to the United States in 1939, 1940. His cover was a German journalist. This is interesting because now we know how Mr. Peter Drucker and Fritz Kramer and the Henry Kissinger's family came to this country in the same time period, and I've accused them of being Nazi spies. He was a double agent for Hitler, who then went on to the Russian front in 1942 and worked with Reinhard Gehlen, Hitler's chief of intelligence, and Otto Skorzeny, the same team that was involved in the Battle of the Bulge, that were involved with collecting the top German generals after the war and putting them in the company of our OSS and incorporating them into the future CIA, Hitler's top people. He was involved with the training of the Cuban invasion, the attempt to get rid of Fidel Castro, and the Bay of Pigs operation. He was active in the Middle East, in Africa. He was in Israel. He was training at Langley, Virginia, and was involved in the Congo with the CIA murder of Patrice Lumumba, and was telling about how the United States had invested more than $10 billion in South Africa and the gold mines and so forth and kept the Soldiers of Fortune going for tremendous profits. And then he said one of the worst-kept secrets of the company, which is the CIA, is the truth of President Kennedy's murder. And he talks about the murder of John Kennedy. And as I say, this is the 20th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination, and a lot of people will want to say, well, if there was a conspiracy, it was the organized crime syndicate. Here's a fellow who says, I was involved, and these were the people that were involved. He's very open about it. Now, 1 year ago tonight, I had a broadcast, May 23rd, broadcast number 546, a very important broadcast. If you're new listeners and don't have that tape, you really should send for it and have it as a collector's item. It was called Treason's Pieces, P-I-E-C-E-S, sort of a play on word after the book Treason's Peace, which is the story of I.G. Farben and the selling or the giving away of America. This was Treason's Pieces, and it's the area where I was zooming in on who is Fritz Kramer, the Battle of the Bulge, Otto Skorzeny, Mr. Himmler, and the meeting of the Nazis that were planning since 1943 to go underground, and how they were involved in this particular area where the battle took place, where so many Americans were killed, and then they all ended up with the top officials of a future that were to run our government, such as Henry Kissinger and Omar Amangal, with the top Nazi officers. And this program that I had, I played a song at the end of the program I'd never put on the broadcast except to open and close for some particular reason, a song of Stephen Sondheim's from Pacific Overture, which is about the selling or giving away of Japan by the Japanese officials when the Americans first appeared with their gunpowder. And it has to do with the Treaty House. And that evening, there was a music show, and various people from KLRB had been driving south from San Jose, listening, or Santa Cruz, listening to the broadcast, and the station manager and so forth were there. And I know they were outraged at this, because I was very angry when I began to understand, and I've understood a lot of this country for a long time, how while people were fighting and winding down the war, that the top people like Alan Dulles and John McCloy and the Kissingers and the Kramers, who later takes care of the whole Pentagon, were all conniving and planning for 2 years on what they would do afterwards. Well, the Americans are thinking that the battle is us against the Germans, and the Germans are working with us planning the next one against the Russians. Well, anyway, I was commenting and angry, and it was a very important broadcast, and then I got a call in the middle of the week saying, that's it. There's no more World Watchers. We're going 24-hour music, no more talk radio. And there was a two-week interim, and there were two stations here that I was invited to be on right away, and within 2 weeks, I was at Kazoo. The other is a privately owned station here, and I decided that a very conservative man who owns it, I decided not to be at the mercy of sponsors who call in, that this is a listener-sponsored station. And if you appreciate it, you can send money to the station, and we have the freedom, as long as they have the people paying to support the station, to stay on the air. And this was a better arrangement. I thought it was a better arrangement. So it's worked out fine, and I've been on almost a year. But what took the thing that really blew them was the betrayal of the Americans, and I think that was the program that got to them. One quick item, a story in the news now, getting onto the news, there's so much. San Francisco Examiner, May 19th, 1983. A story about Terry Moore winning Howard Hughes cash. Many of you who are long listeners know that I met Terry. I went down to Hollywood to make a movie called The Hughes Mystery with Manuel Zecina. The movie film was cut up once. It was spliced a second time. He had to flee the country. It was from Guatemala Nicaragua, rather. And the movie was suppressed. And I met Terry from Manuel Zecina, and we became friends. And I went down and told her a lot about the Hughes organization. She didn't know, and she told me a lot about Howard. And I got a lot of valuable information from her, and from her I met Johnny Meyer, who's up in Canada at the present time. And Terry won the court case that she was married to Howard Hughes, and the article says that she'll get a chunk of the late billionaire's estate. His estate is huge, amounting to over $2 billion. But the article says that she'll get a sizable amount, enough to live in luxury the rest of her life, just using the interest. Well, then it also said that her book may become more interesting now that the final chapter can be added to the book, that she had trouble getting a publisher, but there'll be more interest, that the court has recognized the 1949 arrangement on the high seas on his yacht. It says the decision said it wasn't necessarily proof that she was his wife. However, it was valuable to recognize the court that she was with him quite a long period of time, and up to 8 years, and so she's going to get a settlement. Terry got ripped off. I'll do the strange story of Terry Moore from one saga to the other. She'll give me permission. Some of it is just an amazing story. She's the unsinkable Molly Brown, and I wish her luck. She had some interesting marriages to this Mr. McGrath, his brother's the Archbishop in Panama. I've mentioned him, and Stuart Kramer III, and Howard Hughes, and she had a football player from Texas in between. But she has seen a lot, and she's come out. She walked away from things, certain things, and got hurt and burned because she wasn't the usual kind of starlet in Hollywood. And I just am really happy that this decision came in her favor. Now, I have to update you on three articles on Fritz Kramer, and every once in a while, I know that there are new people that start listening to the program. I hate to repeat it for the old listeners and subscribers, but it still isn't clear in some of your minds, and every few weeks I update Mr. Fritz Kramer. I'm pursuing a gentleman named Mr. Anton F.G. Fritz Kramer, who was in the American Army from 1939, German accent, I.G. Farben family, recruited Henry Kissinger to go to Europe to the Battle of the Bulge, put him at Omer Amigau and at Harvard University with the help of John McCloy. And Nelson Rockefeller and Henry Kissinger then became national security advisor, and you know the route, what he's done to this country, his secret bombings in Cambodia and the murder of Allende and Pakistan, the overthrow of the government. We could do plenty on him. But I've been after Kramer, trying to find out about him, because one Kramer came to this country and recruited Kissinger, went back to Europe, and I've traced his army papers, and there was another Mr. Fritz Kramer, who was Hitler's important general. And I finally obtained a photograph of Fritz Kramer in the United States, who was head of the plans of the Pentagon for years, the advisor to the top officers of the Pentagon. I got a picture of him, I told you before, and I got a picture of the Nazi general Fritz Kramer in the Battle of the Bulge. And I sent Mr. Fritz Kramer in Washington, D.C. to the Institute on Strategic Trade. We've talked about that. I gave you the address. May the 7th, I wrote my letter, Is This You letter. Dear Mr. Kramer, enclosed is a picture of Fritz Kramer taken in 1944 from the Battle of the Bulge. Is that your picture? This is Hitler's Kramer. Are you the same Fritz Kramer? Very short, one more sentence. If you are not the same person, can you tell me where I can locate the other Fritz Kramer in any history book after the Malmedy trials in 1946? Thank you, May Brussels. That was written May the 7th, 1983. This is a tax-deductible institution. I have the telephone, and there's an answering service. You write, and they don't answer. Maybe we should wonder. It's obviously a Defense Department front, but he didn't answer. Now, a friend of mine went up to the Stanford Library, the Hoover Institution on War, Revolution, and Peace. This is the repository of Goebbels' diaries and Hitler's mementos and Himmler's mementos and the Russian Tsarist, and it is for students of history. And a World Watcher listener went up to the Hoover Institute. He went up before to get information on the Malmedy trial, and there's about a page of testimony on Fritz Kramer. I haven't had on the air yet, but he looked up the section on World War II. That's what I want. I have a lot on the American, I say American in quotes because he's German. Okay. So I want the German Fritz Kramer. So he goes to the section on World War II, a card index, looks through the systems, they have notebooks, and they find the name Fritz Kramer. He sees his name on the index file, and there's an interrogation of him, what happened in 1944. The number he requested was CO24. So a lady goes down to the basement and comes back with large boxes of files and folders, and opens the box, and lo and behold, CO24 is missing. The manuscript is not there. It is the documents and archives of Hitler's generals, but CO22 is there, and CO25 is there. These are notebooks on Hitler's generals, but CO23 and CO24 are missing. So Mr. Fritz Kramer is missing from the historical division of the Hoover Institute on War, Revolution, and Peace. And that's what I'm trying to find out. Anything on the German Kramer, but you see what I mean about it being difficult. Now, the third point I want to make about Fritz Kramer, why I'm emphasizing him so much, why he's so important. The Washington Post has a story Monday, May 16th, 1983, page A9. It's a picture of five people from the National Security Staff who are the advisors to Ronald Reagan. And they go in the White House with Mr. William Clark of Military Counterintelligence, who runs the National Security Agency. And it tells how they have access to the president, where Henry Kissinger and Mr. Brzezinski sort of ran the show with Jimmy Carter and with Richard Nixon, that the National Security Advisor has Clark bringing these people in to advise the President of the United States. They have this high position. There's a Jeffrey Kemp, K-E-M-P, from the National Security Council, who's the White House advisor. Alfonso Sapio Bosch, B-O-S-C-H, he's the Latin American advisor. Paula Dobriansky, D-O-B-R-I-A-N-S-K-Y, is the East European advisor. She's only 27 years old. John I can't pronounce it, but I'll spell it for you. Lenczowski, L-E-N-C-Z-O-W-S-K-I. He took over the position of Richard Pipes when Pipes went back to Harvard. He's violently anti-Soviet. He's in the Department of the Soviet Union for the National Security Council. He's 32 years old. He has never been to the Soviet Union. He's the ranking expert on Eastern affairs in the Soviet Union. Dobriansky's 27 and Lenczowski is 32. He says you don't have to be hit by a locomotive to know it's dangerous. And he is against the Soviet Union with the most violent terms. And he's the advisor to Ronald Reagan. Now, under him and along with him, sharing his opinion, is Sven Kramer, S-V-E-N-K-R-A-E-M-E-R. That is the brat that I talked about who worked with the great mafia Nazi collector of young American youth, Reverend Moon. Sven Kramer was instrumental with the Korea Gate story in Tongson Park. This article says that Sven Kramer is a senior defense specialist who has worked for four presidents, Can you imagine? I knew he worked for the National Security Council. Daddy just resigned as plans officer for the entire Pentagon a couple of years ago. He's worked for four presidents, shares Lensowski's assessment, and knows what happens when fascists take control. Now, he says he and his mother were held as hostages by the Nazis in Germany for 6 years. Remember how outraged I was at the Washington Post article a couple of weeks ago on the Hitler diary story where it said that SS Wolf and Mr. Monkey, who was from the death's head, Himmler's death's head, the SS, two of the most dangerous and notorious Nazis in the entire world of the whole Odessa file, were unimportant recruits from 1929 who were unimportant. Well, this has to be the tallest lie of the century, that Sven Kramer, and that's why Kissinger and Brzezinski and Kramer are so important, and Helene von Damm, who came in through William Clark of the National Security Council. Now, if you read the Washington Post, March 2nd, it was 1975, it tells how Daddy, Sven Kramer's grandfather, was with a Habsburg, working with the Habsburgs, was a judge at a very terrible time in German history when the courts were being overturned and the guilty were being locked up and the innocent were freed. His mother had her money from a chemical company. His daddy got a degree in Frankfurt and in Munich and went on to Italy, close to the Italian Mussolini fascism. He married a woman from Sweden, and then took the pregnant wife to London because Fritz Kramer wanted his little baby to be a British citizen, okay? So he doesn't say, I want to take him away from fascism like Germany where Mama is or Italy where Mussolini is. He wanted a British citizenship, just like that Stryker is a double agent for Hitler in this country and in the CIA. These people want double citizenship. Then Sven is born February 3rd, 1938. Then he takes Sven back to Germany in 1939. Hitler invaded Poland. Now, you think Hitler was such a pussycat in 1938 and 39. He takes them to Wiesbaden, to Mama, wife and new baby, and he comes to America. If he can come into America, Mr. Fritz Kramer, and put on an army uniform and recruit Henry Kissinger, if he can be in military intelligence, why can't he bring his wife and baby to the country at the same time? Why does he leave them in Germany? He's talking about oppression, and he has left them with this country that is so oppressive, which is Nazi Germany. At the same time, Uncle Dr. William Kramer, Fritz Kramer's brother, was interned in London as a German spy, rounded up and as a suspect when Germans were rounded up. So here you have Sven Kramer advising four presidents. He's only 45 years old. He goes, you see, dad's at the Pentagon and son is in the National Security Council, just as Alexander Haig's child is overseas with U.S. information and Mr. Clark's child is over there. And Joe Jaworski set up a new CIA foundation with the Anderson funds that his dad had. These kids continue. And this man can advise Ronald Reagan. Where is Reagan getting his cards when he reads his lectures, when he reads his speeches? Sven Kramer, four presidents, only 45 years old. Daddy has the Pentagon. He's like John Dean or these young gophers going back and forth, wanting that war against Russia. He was not a hostage by the Nazis in Germany in any way, shape, or form. They survived just fine. And when the Battle of Bulge was over, when the war was over, old Fritz comes in and knocks on the door and says, "Hi, Mama. Hi, baby. Let's get on to the United States. I'm going to run the Pentagon. And first, we got to get Henry into Harvard, okay? I got my law degrees. We'll get Henry in Harvard. Then he'll be National Security Advisor, and Sven will be his slave, his gopher." That's the way it works. I am so disgusted by the chronology of it. I think you can get by the tone of voice, but it's more than just academic to study who these people are. The decisions they make of who lives, who dies, who goes to war, how much we're going to spend on weapons, how much gas, how much on atomic bombing machines. This is Sven, right off the apple from his dad and mom, National Security Advisor. Now, this last week, May the 17th, Helene von Damm was sworn as envoy to Austria. I sent approximately, I don't know how many letters, $200 of postage and printing money to members of the Senate Intelligence Committee. I wasn't aware of any hearings about her appointment. They're supposed to have investigations and the Senate's to vote. She came to the United States in 1959 from William Clark, from military counterintelligence from Otto von Bolschwing's network, which was the Galen Eichmann Network, and she came out to California to work for Ronald Reagan, and then she went on to make appointments for him when he was president. Now she's going back to Vienna, the home of Otto Skorzeny and the Odessa Network and Adolf Hitler's shenanigans. She is our ambassador to Vienna. It seems that the steamroller is going, and nothing can stop it. I don't mean to sound too gloomy, but you have to be realistic that there are not enough people that are aware of this insidious network that never ceased to exist. Now, one reason people sit back and they're so complacent is that they trust people like Simon Wiesenthal, the typical fraud of the world, to do their work for them, to look out for them, to look out for the Nazis. Wiesenthal didn't find Eichmann. He takes credit for it. The people that found him tell the truth about it. He's made every kind of a deal, and I have absolutely no regard for him one way or the other. But there are two stories in the paper this week that give you an idea of what other people think about Wiesenthal or what he's doing. One was from the Los Angeles Weekly, April 22, 1983. Wiesenthal has a dinner party at the Waldorf Astoria to name the Humanitarian of the Year. The Humanitarian Award, in case you didn't read it and you might have, went to U.S. Ambassador of the United Nations, Jean Kirkpatrick. And the article that I have about Jean Kirkpatrick says, in quotes, for years she was an apologist for neo-Nazi regimes in South America, first as the CIA-associated propagandist frontwoman, then as Reagan's UN ambassador. She has maintained close ties with and done yeoman work for anti-Semitic juntas such as Argentina, Guatemala, Paraguay. She's a strong supporter of the Bolivian junta when they gave refuge to Klaus Barbie. She supports the neo-fascists. She's huckstered for them long before the administration, including Barbie's protectors, came forward and the connections were made of them, the CIA, to Klaus Barbie. She was there. And now the dinner was a fundraiser. Kirkpatrick is strong among the New York Jews, and she was named as the just say we want to raise money. Here's Jean Kirkpatrick, but the Humanitarian of the Award. I think the Jews are going crazy. And Simon Wiesenthal was the one who wanted her to have the Humanitarian Award. Okay, now, this last week, May 17th, I read about an organization. Maybe you've heard about it. Hey, maybe you haven't. It's called the Resistance International, and it's been set up in Paris. One of the founders of the group is Simon Wiesenthal. I'll tell you the punchline before I tell you the story. The purpose of the group is a counteroffensive against Soviet imperialism. The purpose of Resistance International is to act as a counterweight to the European peace movement, and they say that's infiltrated by the Soviets. So to counter this, a group of people, refugees from communist-ruled countries, have formed what they call a Resistance International. A well-known Cuban, someone from the Soviet, someone from Afghanistan, someone from Poland, from Laos, from China, from the communist countries, Mozambique. The only right-wing military government is that they are apprehending is Argentina. But they don't talk about Chile or Paraguay or Uruguay or Colombia or Philippines or South Korea or Saudi Arabia or South Africa or El Salvador, Guatemala, Peru, Brazil, Honduras, you name it. They have set up a group, an organization. The goal of Resistance International is to resurrect a spirit of resistance against Soviet imperialism. And one of the people of this group is none other than Simon Wiesenthal, who's been acting as, I guess, one of the heads of the board that was put on there. Another one is Eugene Ionesco. I told you I went to hear him at Monterey Institute. He was one of my favorite playwrights, and The Rhinoceros was against oppression and about freedom and his other plays. But I wondered why the Monterey Institute, which is closely associated not only with the CIA, but John McCone is on the board of directors of the Institute. They just gave an honorary doctor's degree. He was CIA director at the time John Kennedy was murdered and worked with these Nazi fascist creeps in that position and with the organized crime syndicate from Bechtel McCone, John McCone. He had invited Eugene Ionesco to speak there, and I couldn't figure out why Ionesco was talking there. Now I read that he's in Monterey 2 weeks ago, and now he's in Paris with the resistance group to call attention to the Soviet oppression and to counterweight the peace movement in Europe. That's just what we need. Now, I do want to talk about the Hitler's diaries. I have a few more minutes on this side of the tape, the broadcast, then I'll do more. But I don't want you to think, I didn't mention them last week, we were talking about the Howard Hughes Organization and Chester Davis. I'll get back to that. I don't want you to think that I've forgotten Hitler's diaries. There's stories here that are very important. Save all your articles and read them carefully. Don't let them pass you up. Don't say, ha, it's a fraud. Oh, boy, they wanted money. I got a notice from Tom Davis, who has research where he supplies books for the various people that study history that want to study it. He has new books and old books you can get from him. He sent me a notice of a book that's available out of Phoenix, Arizona. And regarding the Hitler's diary, there's a book called Hitler's Secret Backers, Research Publications, Box 39850, Phoenix, Arizona, 85069, 1495. And in this book about Hitler's backers, there's references on page 16 to Hitler playing nervously with his notebook. This was written in 1930. Page 35, Hitler took out his little notebook, 1931. This book was written a while ago, and it refers to the writings that Hitler did, where he did, in fact, keep notes, and I'll order the book and see what's in there. I mentioned some characters that were involved that were interesting with the diary. That Conrad Fischer is a gentleman I'll go into more next week. Conrad Fischer is the man who collects the military relics and allegedly received the money for whoever did the writing. He's located in Stuttgart. A man for G who's involved with this, the West German police will not reveal his name, is located in the United States. William Hodel, H-O-E-T-T-L-E, lives in Austria, where Von Dahm will be. The home base was once Gorzenny's. Hodel was one of the highest ranking of the Himmler's SS and the Death's Head. He helped form the Odessa, and then Martin Bormann did the genius financial backing of it. He was very important. And Francois Genoud, G-E-N-O-U-D, lives in Switzerland. So Mr. Hartmann is in Germany. Gerd Heisman, he got a death threat this week. Mr. Genoud is in Switzerland. Fischer's in Stuttgart. Manfred is in the United States. Hodel is in Austria. The pieces of the Odessa surfaced. I don't know why at this time. And keep in mind, you have to have one of three opinions or roll them around. One, that Hitler absolutely died. Two, that Hitler escaped. Or three, I don't know. But I want to give you a couple of references to newspaper articles because they're accumulating so fast on this story. One is from the New York Times, May the 6th, saying the diaries are forgeries. But, it said, the police handwriting experts in the Rhineland-Palatinate State, P-A-L-A-T-I-N-A-T-E State, had confirmed the authenticity of Hitler's handwriting. They had, the experts had these sheets, four single sheets of the drafts, in 1982, and also Stern magazine had this material for 2 years. These documents were there the last 2 years. New York Times, May the 8th, said the diaries came in installments, and they had a chance in the last 2 years to check it out. Now, they spent $3 million. Why wouldn't they check it out? London Times, May 8th, said that sources from Stern said the identity of the people is kept secret, but they were able to check any of the documents in their purchase to see if they were genuine. They didn't have to print them. They were given to them to check to see if they were genuine. And if they didn't turn out to be genuine, that was their own problem, Mr. Heidemann said. They had them for 2 years. They had documents, and there was the possibility that they were. I'll do more on that on the second half of this broadcast. We'll take a break for 1 minute now and then get back to the second half.